From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, training Syrians to fight the Islamic State, rescuing migrants in the Mediterranean, a big election in Britain, plus remembering the end of World War II in Europe. Hello, everybody. I'm Steve Norman. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter says the U.S. has started training moderate Syrian rebels in the Middle East, that in an effort to strengthen forces fighting the Islamic State extremist. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has more.
For some Syrian rebels, the wait for U.S. training through years of war is over. The Pentagon says roughly 90 thoroughly vetted rebels have started strengthening their battle skills under the tutelage of U.S. troops, with a second group to start training in a few weeks. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter told reporters the program is deliberately starting small.
It will need to prove itself. So we're starting with the people that we have, that we've vetted very carefully. We're figuring out what the best training is, what the best initial deployment is. We expect that to be successful and therefore to grow.
By training the rebels to fight Islamic State militants, military leaders said the U.S. has assumed some responsibility to protect the rebels once they re-enter Syrian territory. But Carter added the administration has yet to decide exactly how and when the U.S. will support the rebel troops if they are attacked by the forces of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
And we have some obligation to these people. Now they're fighting for their own country. But on the other hand, we definitely have acknowledged that we have an obligation to their safety as well as their effectiveness.
Regional partners behind the training are interested in toppling the Assad government as it continues to lose momentum against the rebels.
I do believe the situation is trending less favorably for the regime. And if I were him, I'd find the opportunity to look to the negotiating table.
However, General Martin Dempsey added the mission is focused on defeating the Islamic State extremist and that any drastic change of rule in Syria could add to the desperate humanitarian crisis there. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Also in the news, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced a new coalition government and he is poised to begin an unprecedented fourth term as head of government. VOA's Scott Bob reports now from Jerusalem.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced the new government after 7 weeks of bargaining and less than 2 hours before a deadline that would have seen the task pass to another parliament member. He says he is sure no one is surprised the negotiations took a while with all the factions, but no one is surprised they ended on time. He says he wants to swear in the new government next week and indicates he hopes to strengthen it by attracting other parties. Mr. Netanyahu was chosen to form the next government after his Likud party defeated in the March elections an opposition alliance led by the rival Labor Party. Labor leader Yitzhak Herzog reiterated that he would not join the new coalition.
All I can say is that the government to be formed is a failed government, which will lead nowhere, which will lead Israel into dangerous directions. We will present a strong, firm opposition that will not enable the government one moment of ability to function. We will challenge it on all fronts.
The new government was formed with a one-seat majority of 61 parliament members. Mr. Netanyahu had hoped to form a larger coalition, but former ally Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman withdrew his right-wing party from the coalition talks. As a result, Mr. Netanyahu was obliged to ally with the ultra-Orthodox religious parties and the hard-line Jewish Home Party of former Economy Minister Naftali Bennett, who advocates expanding Jewish settlements and annexing parts of the Palestinian West Bank. A leader of the Palestine Liberation Organization and former chief peace negotiator Nabil Shaath said the new government gave no hope of advancing the Middle East peace process.
This is a colonial settler cabinet, no doubt about it. It's an extreme right cabinet. It's a cabinet that includes all of those people who want to maintain our occupation. And that's what I said about my very, very little hope that this government is going to really be at all a government of peace.
The Middle East peace process has been stalled since the collapse 1 year ago of U.S.-led negotiations and the subsequent 50-day conflict between Israel and Hamas-led militants in the Gaza Strip. A majority of the Israeli electorate also seemed to see little hope for advancing the peace negotiations. The election campaign focused primarily on domestic issues such as the rising cost of living and the growing gap between rich and poor. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
And here in Washington, the Senate has voted 98-1 to pass a bill allowing Congress to review and vote on any final nuclear accord with Iran. VOA's Michael Bowman reports that the legislation weathered 2 weeks of rancorous debate and now goes to the House of Representatives for consideration.
The bill would freeze sanctions relief for Iran for 30 days, giving Congress time to vote to approve or disapprove a nuclear deal. Republican Senator Bob Corker, who co-authored the bill, explained what would be missing without the legislation.
Without this bill, there is no limitation on the president's use of waivers to suspend the sanctions Congress has put in place. There's no requirement that Congress receive full details of any agreement with Iran. There's no review period for Congress to examine and weigh in on an agreement. There's no requirement that the president certify Iran as complying. And there's really no expedited procedures for Congress to rapidly reimpose sanctions should Iran cheat.
The bill's co-author, Democratic Senator Ben Cardin, said congressional involvement will strengthen America's hand if and when a nuclear accord is reached.
Our goal is to prevent Iran from becoming a nuclear weapon state, pure and simple. We'll be in a stronger position to achieve that objective with the passage of this legislation.
The lone senator to vote against the bill was a newcomer to the body who has made a name for himself as a lead anti-negotiations agitator. 2 months ago, first-term Republican Tom Cotton wrote an open letter to Iran warning that Congress could undo any nuclear agreement. Days ago, he engaged in a testy Twitter exchange with Iran's foreign minister. Cotton was one of several Republicans pushing contentious amendments demanding Tehran's recognition of Israel's right to exist, among other provisions. The Senate blocked or voted down so-called poison pill amendments that would have triggered a presidential veto, angering Cotton and other Republicans like Ted Cruz.
Our first priority should be stopping a bad Iran deal that jeopardizes the lives of millions of Americans and millions of our allies.
The White House initially opposed any congressional conditions on a nuclear deal, arguing such provisions would undermine delicate international negotiations that last month produced a framework accord with Iran. But the administration signaled grudging support for the bill moments before its unanimous approval by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in April. The legislation goes to the House, where Speaker John Boehner says he looks forward to the chamber acting, quote, to hold President Obama's administration accountable. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
U.S. Appeals Court in New York on Thursday ruled the clandestine National Security Agency's massive collection of phone records of Americans is illegal, far exceeding the scope of what Congress authorized. In Congress, Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal welcomed the court decision.
This appellate court ruling is really a historic breakthrough because it shows that the FISA court got it wrong, disastrously wrong, and will continue to get it wrong unless it is fundamentally reformed.
But the ending data collection is a mistake, according to Republican Senator Dan Coats, who strongly disagrees with the court ruling.
Coupled with this announcement this morning is the proclamation by ISIS that they have a significant number of people embedded in America, and there are more terrorist attacks to come, so watch out. This program helps us thwart those terrorist attacks, and it's done so, and we need to have it continue to do so.
Congress so far has been unable to agree on what the scope of the surveillance should be in the future. House of Representatives last year, with the support of President Obama, approved a modified phone data collection program, but the legislation failed in the Senate. The appeals court Thursday said the case served as an example of the increasing complexity of balancing the paramount interest in protecting the security of our nation with the privacy rights of individuals. U.S. officials say steel spikes will be added to the White House fence in an effort to beef up security. The steel spikes will measure 18 centimeters tall, with 1 centimeter, a steel pencil point at the top, sticking out of multiple inches to create an acute angle with a second layer of spikes with the existing iron picket fence. If you were to ever look at it, you would see this would be a significant difference. The move comes after a string of high-profile security breaches at the White House. In September, a disturbed Army veteran jumped the White House fence, sprinted across the lawn, and entered the building with a knife in his pocket. In April, Secret Service agents arrested an intruder who scaled the fence on the south side of the presidential mansion.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
and civilians. Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians. This
with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Voters in Britain went to the polls on Thursday, a nationwide parliamentary election. 20-year-old student has become the youngest lawmaker for centuries now, defeating one of the country's most senior politicians. Mary Black of the Scottish National Party defeated Labour's Douglas Alexander. Black is part of the SNP tie that is sweeping Scotland. The party, which supports independence for Scotland, had only 6 seats before Thursday's election. It is now forecast to take almost all of Scotland's 59 seats, most of them from Labour. An exit poll is predicting that Prime Minister David Cameron's Conservative Party has fared much better than expected. Cameron's coalition partner, the Liberal Democratic Party, is expected to lose most of its seats. London Mayor Boris Johnson, who ran for a seat as a Conservative lawmaker, spoke with reporters.
We're quite optimistic. We're quite optimistic.
Are you hoping that Mr. Cameron will keep your seat warm for the next election?
We're not counting. I don't think anybody should count their chickens, but clearly, if the exit poll is correct, it's a fantastic result.
And Natalie Bennett heads the Green Party.
First of all, we need to treat this exit poll with extreme caution. We're in a new age of multi-party politics. We're extremely unlikely to be seeing a uniform swing across the country. So I think, you know, it will be in a few hours when we'll know what the voters actually said. And it's really not very useful to speculate until then. But nevertheless, if we've doubled our parliamentary representation, we're sending, you know, perhaps Darren Hall in Bristol West to join the brilliant Caroline Lucas in Brighton Pavilion as a strong group of Green MPs in Parliament, then that will be a good result for the Green Party.
The vote on Thursday has shaken the grip of the three parties that have dominated British politics. That's the Conservative Party, the opposition Labour Party, and the Liberal Democrats. The exit poll on Thursday predicted that Conservatives would capture 316 seats in the 650-seat House of Commons, with Labour taking only 239 seats and the Liberal Democrats down 10 seats, to 10 seats, that is, from their current 56. Latest group of migrants rescued at sea by Italian crews while trying to reach Europe included people escaping Somalia as well as Egypt and Sudan. Authorities are saying the migrants, including a dozen unaccompanied minors, arrived at an Italian port city on the island of Sicily. Francine Yonuma is a spokesperson for Save the Children.
They said it was very rough. They were out at sea for about 12 days, they estimated, and for two of those days, the boat stopped and was not working, and they ran out of water, and they were even drinking salt water. They weren't able to be hydrated during that time, so until the boat was going again, they were completely stopped for 2 days.
Recent surge in migrants risking their lives to reach Europe has set off a debate on how to stop the exodus. French President François Hollande has said he wants a UN resolution authorizing the EU to destroy boats used by people smugglers to ferry thousands of migrants from North Africa to Europe. But the president of the Italian Red Cross, Francesco Rocca, warned that suggestions of bombing traffickers' boats before they are loaded with migrants is not a solution.
For us, it's not a solution, bombing the boats. This is, must be very clear, because the traffickers will find other routes. We cannot forget that the other route is coming from Turkey, from the Aegean Sea. Even some of them try to reach the Greek island from swimming.
Rocca says the current migrant situation is not a crisis, but in his opinion, the continuation of governments not responding to decades-old dilemma. With no immediate plan to disrupt the flow of migrants to Europe, the EU has decided to triple search and rescue operations after being criticized over its response to the migrant crisis. And Germany is holding a summit on refugees today as the number of people seeking asylum in that country has doubled in a year. Close to 30,000 migrants are believed to have crossed the Mediterranean from Africa to Europe so far in 2015, many of them heading north in the hope of finding better welfare programs and jobs as well. Henry Ridgewell has been following the migrants' trail through Europe and took the train from Italy to Munich in Germany for this report.
The first migrants boarded the Verona to Munich express train at Brenner, the last stop in Italy on the mountainous Austrian border. They were mostly Somalis and Eritreans. They carried no possessions. Nervously, they made their way through the cars. Some sat in vacant seats, others waited in corridors. The first police officers came aboard at Rosenheim, just inside Germany, and began checking passports. One by one, the migrants were led off the train. After half an hour, more than 70 were lined up on the platform as the other passengers stared through the windows. Under Europe's so-called Dublin regulations, migrants are meant to apply for asylum in the country where they first arrive, so they often refuse to reveal their identity or give fingerprints until they get to their final destination, often Germany or other wealthy northern European states. Few migrants want to stay in southern Europe, explains Rebecca Killian-Mason of the Munich Refugee Council.
Like in Greece, you have huge problems, and in Greece no one is sent back to Greece at the moment because the situation is so awful. With Italy, there are still a lot of people sent back to Italy through Dublin, and that is quite problematic because a lot of people are homeless in Italy, they don't get social support.
But they do get that support in Germany. 173,000 people applied for asylum here in 2014. The rate has doubled in 2015. Among them is James from Sierra Leone. He's now living in refugee accommodation in Munich, but first set foot in Europe by illegally entering the Spanish enclave of Melilla in North Africa. He hopes the German authorities will look kindly on his asylum application.
It hurts me when I heard that maybe they're going to send me back to Spain. Sometimes it hurts me. I just don't want to think about it. Yeah, I can tell you, me being here is worth risking life for.
The huge number of asylum cases means the authorities are overwhelmed, so only a fraction of those eligible are actually returned to their country of arrival, says Franziska Fassbinder, who provides free advice to migrants through the Munich Refugee Law Clinic.
Because we have only a short time slot where they can bring this person back. This is about 6 months. And when a refugee comes to Germany, we often tell him or her just to wait.
Many asylum seekers are rejected on the grounds that they are economic migrants rather than refugees fleeing war. It is a difficult distinction, argues Fassbinder.
I would also ask the question, is it really an economic reason if I can't get any food?
Rich European nations like Germany are famous for their welfare programs and social care, but the influx of migrants fleeing both war and poverty is testing the will of governments and people across the continent. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Munich, Germany.
The 70th anniversary of the end of World War II is being marked in all European countries today and tomorrow, except Germany, which lost that war. VOA's Al Pessin visited Berlin to report on how the Second World War is viewed there and the impact it is still having.
The stark and extensive memorial to the 6 million Jews killed by the Nazis takes up a large area in central Berlin. It was built just 10 years ago, even then amid considerable controversy. 200 meters away, behind those trees, sat the bunker where Adolf Hitler directed the war effort and is believed to have committed suicide.
Beneath there, that is where the first bunker was built.
There's nothing left now under this parking lot, but for visitors like Tina from Britain, the lessons remain.
Even today, in our own country, there are extremist groups cropping up, and I'm thinking that if sort of ordinary, decent people don't do anything, there's always the chance of history repeating itself.
And that's the message aimed at Berliners through a video and photo exhibit on display in several parts of this once divided city.
And we are right in front of where it originally was.
Björn Weigel is the curator.
This was 70 years ago, but in other parts of the world, and even in other parts of Europe, this is everyday life.
The theme is not lost on Europeans visiting Berlin, who know well that May 1945 was not the end of the continent's trouble.
For us, for Polish, that means the end of the destroying our country. But we were controlled by Soviets, so this is not very meaningful. For us, but we celebrate it.
We don't know what's happening when it's not going like that. Maybe it's another world here, in Germany, in France, in all Europa.
For Germans and for me, it is a day that will not be forgotten, that cannot be forgotten.
Gerd Oppenzeller is a member of the editorial board at Berlin's Tagesspiegel newspaper and its former publisher. He worries that the post-war alliances that secured and reunited Germany are shifting, just as Russia is becoming more assertive and a new generation of Germans is taking peace for granted.
The vast majority have gotten comfortable with freedom. They give little thought to the fact that this freedom is constantly in danger. America is changing, global relations are changing, and the Germans and the Europeans have to unite and stay together just to remain a relevant partner for the United States.
The new U.S. Embassy in Berlin seems to underscore that partnership, standing right next to the Brandenburg Gate, one of Germany's national symbols and once a symbol of the East-West divide. Al Pessin, VOA News, Berlin.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
A couple of years ago, the British journal The Lancet asked a group of experts to assess the global state of surgery. That panel now reports finding a major gap between the need for surgery and what is actually available, especially in low- and middle-income countries. Art Chimes has details.
In its report published by The Lancet, the group says people are dying from conditions easily treated in the operating room, such as hernia, appendicitis, obstructed labor, and serious fractures. Stanford University surgery professor Thomas Weiser, a member of The Lancet Commission, says the need is great.
There are probably about 143 million operations that are needed just to meet basic needs in low- and middle-income countries. There are probably about 5 billion people that don't have access to safe, timely surgery with protection against catastrophic expenditure. And so those are, you know, pretty big numbers.
The Lancet Commission notes remarkable gains in global health over the last quarter century, but says surgery has not kept up with advances in other areas.
You can't achieve universal health care if you don't incorporate surgery.
Harvard Medical School's John Mira is one of the lead authors of the Lancet paper. Mira said increasing the availability of surgical treatments is not as simple as providing bed nets designed to protect against malaria. Surgery requires trained staff, proper facilities, and sterile instruments, but also reliable electricity, a system for getting patients to often distant hospitals, and a business model that does not bankrupt those who need an operation. The report suggests spending an additional $300 to $420 billion on surgery between now and 2030. That's a lot of money, but Mira says the Lancet Commission calculated each dollar spent would return $3 or $4 in economic benefit from lives saved and people returned to productive good health.
When you look at cost effectiveness in terms of dollars spent for welfare gains, for the positive impact on human beings, surgery is every bit as cost effective as any of those other aspects.
There's no one best path for improving access to surgery, and the report cites several diverse countries, including Mexico and Rwanda, as having taken steps toward better availability of surgical services. For VOA News, this is Art Chimes reporting.
And a new study says that measles can continue to weaken the body's immune system up for 3 years, much longer than previously known. Researchers in the journal Science say measles play havoc with what they call immune amnesia. That's a phenomenon that destroys the immune system's ability to remember how to fight off other diseases, including pneumonia and meningitis. Princeton University professor and co-author of the study, Jessica Metcalf, says, in other words, if you get measles 3 years down the road, for instance, you can die from something that you would not have died from had you not been infected with measles. Researchers do say they have some good news. They found that vaccinating children against measles led to a drop in deaths from other potentially deadly infections. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. The news is straight ahead. Please stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
I'm Neil Arcega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Togolese President Faure Gnassingbé has been sworn in for a third term leading the West African nation, following his victory in the April 25th presidential balloting. Togo's Constitutional Court confirmed the National Election Commission's tally, finding that the president polled 59% of the more than 1.2 million votes cast, to leading opposition candidate Jean-Pierre Fabre's 35%. While Togo's main opposition party voiced concerns over the voting count, and civil society noted broader concerns about the electoral process leading up to Election Day, international observers, including the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, the African Union, and the Gore Institute, judged the election free and fair. Equally important, Mr. Fabre and others conceded the results, sparing the nation the kind of political tension and protest that cost hundreds of lives after the 2005 election. The United States congratulates the people of Togo on exercising their democratic rights, and we look forward to continuing to work with President Gnassingbé to strengthen Togo's democracy and build a prosperous nation for the Togolese people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.